Case, Mr. Hayden, Mr. Bourne. Do you want one right now? And Mr. Hayden, do you desire to reserve any rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes. So.
Certainly.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Hayden. I represent Claude Davis, who was convicted in a jury trial in the Newport News Circuit Court of four offenses, including attempted arson and breaking and entering with intent to commit larceny. He received a 9-year and 3-month active sentence from the jury. We've assigned it as error that the trial court erred in denying Davis's request for a Franks hearing. The U.S. Supreme Court case sets forth a procedure for challenging search warrants. And the Franks, the U.S. Supreme Court said in Franks that where a defendant makes a substantial preliminary showing that false statement knowingly and intentionally or with reckless regard for the truth was included by the affiant in a warrant affidavit, and if the allegedly false statement is necessary to the finding of probable cause, then the Fourth Amendment requires that a hearing be held at the defendant's request. Well, the defense counsel in this case made a proffer, we would submit, that was sufficient to make a substantial preliminary showing. In this case, the defense counsel noted several important facts that the affiant Detective Setter withheld from the magistrate making a determination of whether or not to issue search warrants, the two search warrants. For example, Detective Center wrote in great detail on page 3 of the affidavit about an incident of arson that occurred in Illinois in 2001 that Davis was supposed to have perpetrated against an ex-girlfriend in a manner similar to the purported arson in this case at Barr. But Detective Center omitted to mention in the affidavit that Davis was never convicted of the 2001 arson, and that in fact all charges against Davis related to that incident had been dismissed.
Mr. Hayden, could I ask you on this, how is this different from the Virginia Supreme Court's case in Barnes versus Commonwealth, where they say essentially if you've had a Franks hearing already, those issues have been dealt with in a motion to suppress hearing, that's sufficient as long as it was dealt with there.
Well, the unusual thing about this case was that there was originally a suppression hearing held with different defense counsel, just focusing purely on suppression issues, Fourth Amendment issues, and that was denied. But then subsequent counsel comes in, notes subsequently, aspects that the original counsel didn't know that make it qualify for a Franks hearing. The original hearing was just simply a suppression hearing based on Fourth Amendment, not a Franks hearing.
But so, these issues regarding that,
they're similar,
that matter that was dismissed, that didn't come up?
I don't think that it was noted in the original suppression hearing that Detective Center withheld information from the magistrate at the original suppression hearing that all this detailed information about an arson in Illinois had he'd never been convicted of, and that was not brought out. So while admittedly a suppression hearing and Frank's hearings are awfully similar in a lot of ways, they are two different things. And so once the defense counsel became aware of the omitted information and raises it in a new Franks proceeding, the Supreme Court says he's entitled under the Fourth Amendment to have the Franks hearing, and it didn't occur in this case. The detective was asked if his intent in describing the Illinois arson incident in his affidavit was to convince the magistrate of the existence of probable cause based on the events in Illinois. Detective Center replied, quote, absolutely. And so he's, but he doesn't mention that, well, by the way, there's no proof he was ever guilty of this. In fact, all charges were dismissed. I never made any attempt to corroborate the information by contacting the original detective or the original victim to try to verify if there was some basis for believing that this information was legitimate. Didn't ask for any kind of documentation of the transaction. So we would submit that there was a sufficient, substantial preliminary showing that's all that they have to do. They don't have to prove absolutely that the detective intended. They just have to make the substantial preliminary showing. Then the hearing is required, and it wasn't conducted in this case. I would like to briefly touch on the other issue. Another issue that was raised was there was alibi evidence presented at the trial that the defendant worked with an individual at Metro Marine named Fields, and they worked on the 21st of May, and then that evening went and played pool, and at the time when this incident was supposed to have happened. So there's this detailed testimony about that that was a critical element of the defendant's case, this alibi evidence. The defendant or the witness Fields did get mixed up about the day of whether it was a Friday or a Saturday that this thing occurred on, but I would submit that's an understandable human type error. Nevertheless, that it's evidence that that it is not self-impeaching that he gets a detail mixed up about whether it was a Friday or Saturday. So the Commonwealth then proceeds to bring in this.
Doesn't that make a pretty big difference here? Because this happened on a Saturday evening, right?
Yes, the offense happened on a Saturday,
and
not a Friday. The Fields thought
he says,
that,
you know, we go out drinking and we'd been at work together. And that's when it leads into, well, no, we didn't pay him to work that day. And it also, isn't this the only time that this Mr. Fields ever said that he and appellant did this, where they sort of went and hung out and drank together?
I think that's true. All of that is true. It's certainly a circumstance that, it's certainly a factor to consider, but it's not something that conclusively says this is impeached and therefore we entirely disregard this evidence. What the Commonwealth seeks to do is to bring in what is pure hearsay. It's not admissible under the business records exception of this individual, who's Mr. Rice, who's called to the stand, who apparently is a subcontractor for payroll records, and he says, well, I had emailed to me by Metro Marine, who I don't work for and who I'm not the custodian records for, but they emailed me this thing that says he didn't work on May 21st. And pure hearsay doesn't fall within any exception to the hearsay rule, and there's no ability to cross-examine and test for reliability, and it was very definitely, I don't see how it would fall within the rules of an exception to the hearsay rule under these facts, and yet the evidence was allowed in, and we would say that it was not a harmless error because it went right to the heart of the defendant's defense in this case, his alibi evidence. So I think the issue is adequately set forth in the brief. If there's no questions, I'll just simply reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hayden.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellee of the Commonwealth of Virginia. With regard to the search warrant issue, no reversible error occurred here. First of all, the only assignment of error that has been raised on appeal has to do with the procedure, not the substance of what happened at this hearing. And it was conceded at the second hearing, which is on page 119 of the appendix, that was conceded on, I believe, on page 124 and page 132 in two separate statements, that the same exact issues were raised. And the second judge asked the second attorney several times, what did you not get at the first hearing that you think you deserve in this second hearing? And he conceded that the same issues were addressed and could not articulate anything new that he felt he was denied. And in a Franks hearing, actually a Franks hearing benefit, I mean, is very difficult bar, as he conceded, for the defendant. So if he actually got an easier burden because they didn't do the proper hearing or type of hearing at in the first motion to suppress and didn't have to deal with as stringent of standards as he would have for an actual Franks hearing, he has failed to articulate how that prejudiced him in any way. Moreover, he certainly would have been able to raise those substantive issues on appeal because this court has said that even if a Franks hearing is not properly held, it still will reach the merits of those issues in several different cases which I've cited on brief. So, he had his Franks hearing. He argued, and I frankly don't understand where this business is about these particular issues weren't raised. They absolutely were raised during that motion to suppress, that initial motion to suppress, where the first lawyer said that there were reckless falsehoods made or omissions made because he didn't specifically say that this matter had been dismissed later on. Those issues were brought out. He cited a case, Bickford, which was my case below, and it was a Franks case. It cites Franks. And, of course, we presume that the judge knows these cases and understands what they stand for. And since it was a Franks case and it was brought to the court's attention and the court asked questions which indicated that he understood what the arguments were in this matter, he certainly got everything he was entitled to. But even if there was some sort of procedural issue, and even if the assignment of error in this case actually reached the merits of the Franks question, there clearly, even had the proper procedure been done, there was clearly no problem here because there was no reckless omission. It's clear from the questions that were asked that the officer only looked at an NCIC report and that the actual statements that are in the affidavit in this case involve what was reported, the fact that there was a report. So there is no false statement. It doesn't say that he was convicted or anything else. And the officer at that point had not seen or had not called the court to find out the disposition of this case. You know, Franks does not require, you can't reverse an affidavit which has a presumption of validity because the officer fails to do an adequate investigation prior to getting an affidavit for a search warrant. It has to be more than an inadequate investigation. It has to be some deliberate falsehood or material reckless omission, which was not made in this case. But even if all of those things had been proven, which they were not, the second part of Franks certainly wasn't met, the second requirement, because this even if this had been excluded, the same evidence that essentially came in at trial was still left in the affidavit, which was that these items, this jewelry, had been caught with his wife's jewelry 2 days after this break-in. So there was certainly enough for probable cause, even had this information been excluded from the affidavit and search warrant. So for all of those reasons, I would urge you to affirm on that issue. With regard to the admissibility of the evidence issue, you know, the testimony in this case was, I did not pay him. The other stuff was foundational evidence. So the testimony was, I did not pay him. That's not hearsay. And no exception to the hearsay rule is required for it to be admissible. In fact, under Friend and various other cases which cited on brief, which I won't belabor here, a person can refresh his recollection from any evidence, and it doesn't have to be admissible for him to refresh his recollection. So here, he refreshed his recollection. He was able to say independently he didn't pay him, and there was no hearsay violation. But even if there were a hearsay violation in this case, which there was not because it wasn't hearsay, it was clearly harmless under the facts of this case. And that is because this alleged alibi witness didn't even provide an alibi, or a very good alibi, which could have had any effect on this case, because he had the date wrong. He said, well, this is the only time we went drinking together, and he was asked on two separate occasions, was it on a Friday? And he said, yes, it was on a Friday. And of course, this offense occurred on a Saturday. Also, he said, I don't really know what time he got there. He was asked what time. Well, it was 6 or 6:15. I wasn't paying no attention to the time. That's what he said. So this did not provide an alibi for the defendant. And since counsel has not argued about the final assignment of error, the sufficiency, I guess I don't have anything to respond to on that issue, but I would just rely on brief, and I would note that the evidence was sufficient in this matter. Unless the court has any further questions for me, I would just ask that you affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Horn. Mr. Hayden.
I don't have any additional comments to make.
Thank you, sir. We'll come down and greet counsel, and then we're going to take what I hope to be around a 15-minute break. It's going to take that long.